My passport did not allow me to go to Israel. It was only countries that my passport couldn't go there.
Whoa.
And so we're like, what? You know, I grew up with this idea, like, they don't want us.
So you've got evil there that somehow must be uprooted. That's above my pay grade. I don't know how you do that.
Okay, what is the Church of Jesus supposed to do regardless? That's a better question.
Christians, we see persecution as something, Lord, please rapture us up so we don't have to be persecuted. And the church flourishes in persecution. Why would we not dig deeper into the Spirit and say, Lord, use me during this time of great persecution?
I have people going, why are you apologizing? And I'm like, I represent someone. So a people group, like I look like, I represent or people that have caused pain in other people. So I'm just stepping in. I'm just trying to do the right thing here.
My job, my purpose is to bring the kingdom rule of God into every situation, which is not political, nor is it physical. It is the love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, long-suffering. It's spreading the kingdom to everybody I encounter and I touch.
Just because I don't believe or agree doesn't mean I can't learn from you.
Why did you have to bring that up?
Okay, that one I'm super embarrassed about.
Do you like me?
Do I like you?
Yeah.
As an individual or as a podcast?
Yeah, as a person.
No, I like you.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Cool.
And I don't have any interest in appearing to be stronger than I am.
I ain't bowed to Nebuchadnezzar's statue. He gonna leave. You feel me?
How do we love people who see the world differently than we do?
What would it look like if we truly loved all of our neighbors? Could listening to their stories be the first step? This is Seacoast Church, and there's way more to talk about.
Pastor Naeem Fazel pastors Mosaic Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's a former pastor at Seacoast and will always be a part of this church family. It was neat for me to see him and Pastor Greg reconnect as they have a ton of history, lots of time invested in a discipleship relationship and just a friendship. Naeem was born in Kuwait, is a former Muslim. You'll hear in a second that he was in Kuwait during the Iraqi invasion in the early 90s. The three of us discuss evil in the context of what's going on in Israel today. Most importantly, we discuss and ponder what heart posture God would call us to, given, you know, the two greatest commandments. All in the show notes. Naeem wrote a book, Ex-Muslim, and his church also produces a podcast with their host, Kristen Young. You may enjoy checking that one out too. So thanks for listening as always, and maybe you'll get a thing or two out of this one. Enjoy. Welcome back to the Seacoast Podcast. You and Josh were one of the first episodes this year. You and I were talking about you coming back on, and you mentioned Israel, and I thought, man, let's take a bird's eye view, go back a little bit,
right,
and have a general discussion on the the proper way of saying the religion of Islam. Correct? That's the name of the religion is Islam, and Muslims have the
Islam. Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think you may know a little bit about Muslims, considering you wrote a book called Ex-Muslim.
Right. I should. At least how to exit out of religion.
How old were you when you deconverted, so to speak, from the Muslim faith?
Yeah. My story is that I was 19, 18 kind of deal. That's when it happened. And, you know, I grew up in the Middle East in Kuwait. Parents are Pakistani, but we grew up Sunni Muslim. I came to the States after the Gulf War. So I've been in, physical a war where neighboring country invades another neighboring country. So two Muslim Arab nations go to war. So I was there as a civilian. We stayed there throughout the liberation and occupation, and then invasion, occupation, and then the liberation. Okay. And then came here in the 90s, 92.
So from y'all's perspective in Kuwait, and I know everybody's not necessarily perfectly on the same page, was America like heroic to you guys? Like, were y'all like, man, thank you so much for these Americans doing this, coming and helping us?
I mean, honestly, it was, yes, there was definitely an American-led team, but it was a united front. So the first soldiers that I encountered were not Americans that came in. I think it was like kind of a global effort. with the Americans leading the way.
Yeah. So growing up, what were you taught specifically about Israel? Was there a certain sort of framework that you were given as a child?
You know, I actually remember, so strangely enough, I remember being in a classroom where there was a conversation about Jewish people. And it was not, we didn't necessarily use the idea of like Israel in terms of what land it occupies. It was just the idea of just Jews, Jewish people. And I remember asking my teacher, why do we hate the Jews?
Whoa.
And she didn't have a good answer. She didn't have a good answer. And I still remember that. I mean, I might have been 12 years old.
Now, how did you know that? Like, where did you pick that up from, that we hate the Jews?
Well, partly because, like, my passport, the Pakistani passport, now Pakistanis are not Arabs, but Pakistanis are Muslims, conservative Muslims. My passport did not allow me to go to Israel. It was one of only countries that my passport couldn't go there.
Whoa.
And so we're like, what, you know, I grew up with this idea, like they don't want us and we don't want them. So, but I don't know why. It was like, you know, knowing that a family member, we don't talk and we hate each other, but no one knows why. We take that idea and you pass it through not just Arabs, but also other nations and other people groups that are practicing Islam. There are people groups out there that are not Arabs that have no dog in the fight for some reason, just don't understand why. It seems like, oh, the Jews are just suppressing the Arabs. So it's like a false narrative that has continued generationally.
Did you ever get your answer as far as...
No.
Nobody gave you a good answer.
I think that no one gave me a good answer. I mean, I think like when you sit down and really nuance this thing and realize like what are we doing here? I don't think real people with the humility to actually like kind of dive in and figure out like, well, let's ask the right questions instead of just getting the answers of questions we already want to ask.
Isn't it crazy how I bet part of the reason why you didn't get a good answer is because a lot of people didn't know, which is so crazy.
They didn't know.
It's like there's so much hatred in this world. And I think there's some people, if you ask like, well, so what's the deal? But I don't know. We just hate them.
I don't know.
Yeah. We just taught to hate them.
Yeah.
Oh, that sucks.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, the same thing. I mean, it's not just Israel, you know, Jewish and Arab thing. You know, it's Pakistanis and Indians. You know, so we in neighboring countries split up in the 40s, devastation, thousands of people killed. And I, even as an American citizen now, it's either impossible for me or extremely hard for me to get a visa to India because my parents are Pakistanis, because they consider all Pakistanis terrorists.
Wow.
All of them. One of my best friends growing up, his daughter's getting married. And he was like, hey, man, we'd love for you to come out. And I'm like, you know, bro, there's no way I can come out. I'm not going to get a visa.
Still today.
Today.
Gosh.
Like, he's trying to get me a visa and see if there's a way. In fact, in some cities, if you fly in or some conditions of visas is that if a Pakistani does get in somehow, I mean, you have to be a politician or you have to be a celebrity to get in, you know? But even that, like he lives in New Delhi, and he was like, man, the only thing is we have to report to the local police station every day when you're here. But I could probably bribe someone to act like you and show up. That's kind of the restrictions they've got going on right now. So Anyways, I think people groups, regardless, I mean, if they find themselves hating each other, they're going to figure out ways to dehumanize and oppress.
Yeah. So you talked about living through the Operation Desert Storm, I think is what we called it here in the States.
Yeah.
And it made me think with what's going on right now in Israel, then, and I'm looking at the geography, it's like all these countries are bordering one another, and a lot of these countries have animosity and hatred towards one another. And I don't have any context for that sort of setup. Georgia, North Carolina, we're all good. I don't know what that feels like. You know, 9/11 did change some things. Obviously, we realized that we were vulnerable on our home turf, so to speak. But we typically live here with an assumption of safety when it comes to other countries. Like, people just don't have that over yonder.
Over yonder.
Right?
The assumption of safety. Yes. I mean, I think there are parts of the world that assume they are safe as well. People in, you know, certain parts in Europe feel the same as Americans do. I think there are parts of the Arab world that feel that too. You know, Saudi Arabia feels very secure, I would say. There are certain parts of the Middle East that feel that as well. There are nations in this world that just have never had that opportunity. You know, even African nations have not had that. They're still at war. Muslims are killing Muslims even now in Libya. So I think the bigger question might be is like, what is our response to this? Like, what do we do? You know, because the Church of Jesus doesn't exist just here. It exists all over the world. And so sometimes it feels like we find ourselves trying to figure out what would Jesus do as it applies to being in Africa or as it applies to being in the U.S. And I feel like if there is a way to actually step back and go, you know, okay, what is the Church of Jesus supposed to do regardless? That's a better question. If you assume safety or you don't assume safety, what are we supposed to act? What are we supposed to do? And even the teachings of Jesus was a communicated majority to a people group who are oppressed, you know? So it was in the context or the pool of conflict. And yeah. So no one has had safety. They were the minorities and all that. And so the teachings of Jesus were seemingly ridiculous. And I would say that, you know, historically, it would seem like that, you know, even the disciples and the Jewish people thought he was a pacifist. I mean, after Jesus, I think historians say that there was another guy who showed up and was a political figure and tried to liberate the Jewish people from the Romans after Jesus, the resurrection. And that decimated the Jewish people. I mean, that did a big thing. I mean, that's when they just went crazy and they just demolished all kinds of things. And they got so angry, and that's why they destroyed the temple, you know? So,
yeah. I would love for you to give us kind of a Hamas Gaza 101 snapshot. What I'm curious about, there he is.
Hey.
Hey, hey. Can you hear me?
We can.
Yes, we got you.
Naeem is about to give us a Gaza Hamas 101 for dummies. Give us a little snapshot.
Oh, my gosh. For dummies or by dummy?
Yeah, I was just with Mark Turnage for breakfast. Got a little bit of that also.
Yeah. From a dummy to the rest of the dummies then.
Like, first of all, I mean, you know, I'm here talking about this stuff. And for the longest time, I didn't even want to put my voice into this. One, I mean, just because I grew up Muslim as a Pakistani in Kuwait doesn't make me an expert on any of this. Or nor does it make me a history, you know, make me an expert on the history of all of this stuff as well. So what we know of Hamas is that it came to power. I think it was a 40% vote. And it was not necessarily the best pick for the people living there. And then after that, they just never held an election. So they just took assumed power. I kind of relate to this idea of when Saddam Hussein took over Iraq. He was a military leader, took over, killed the president, and then started a dictatorship, and then ruled the country and did whatever he wanted to do. And Hamas is pretty much doing that. What's interesting is that Hamas is something that I think people need to understand that, you know, even the Arab councils, like one of the major Arab councils, the Islamic Fatwa Council of Iraq, actually came out with a fatwa, which I will explain. And basically, it just rejected the idea of Hamas speaking for Arabs or Palestinians. Let me explain what fatwa is.
Yeah, please.
Fatwa, it happens in different stages where it's a religious statement, a declaration that happens. Now, this is the council that is in Iraq, and it's like the main guys who put these declarations out there for this is what the Arabs feel. This is what they make the statements for the Islamic Council or people group. But a fatwa is actually something that a pastor or imam can make as well in a local place. So like, for example, like if I don't know if you guys remember, I think Greg, you'll remember this when Saddam Rushdie wrote the book, Satanic Verses.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they put a fatwa against him. So you hear this word, it's a fatwa. And you what you think is it's a death sentence. Well, fatwa is not necessarily a death sentence. It's basically, this is what we believe should happen. Like, for example, I became an ex-Muslim. And so if I lived in Pakistan and my local imam could put a fatwa on me, and that fatwa would be a, hey, this guy's broken the Sharia law, punishable by death, go get him. So that's kind of the idea of a fatwa. So Islamic Fatwa Council in Iraq issued a fatwa, a religious edict, I think a couple of weeks ago, condemning Hamas. They're condemning Hamas. They were calling them out for what they're doing. You know, started talking about how Hamas has been you know, using child soldiers, falsely accusing Palestinians of treason. And as the decree basically was that Muslims all over the world should not pray, support, finance, or fight on behalf of Hamas. So, I mean, this is pretty interesting that they were one of the first ones to come and condemn this. But
Muslims.
Muslims, yeah. Part of their fatwa, if I'm reading this correctly, is to reclaim the Islamic legal system from extremists, Islamists, and supporters of terrorism. So Hamas is obviously a terrorist group that has all kinds of agendas, one being killing innocent people and taking over a land that they think that's theirs. Like, in a sense, terraforming that land into something that they want, a world that they want to live in, not necessarily a land for Arabs. I put a post a couple of weeks ago out there when this stuff went down, and I really was trying to maybe even just answer the question or give a perspective on the question that you asked. And that is, like, what is it? What's the reaction? What are we supposed to do? And for me, I was like, we need to stand with Israelis, we need to stand with Palestinians, and we need to stand against evil. And to understand that the opportunity that the church has right now to really come in and be the church and not be a political or a governmental authority. The church can be the church. And the way to do that is to make this a very human conversation. Even though other people want to make it a very much a political conversation or anything like that. But my response as a pastor, local pastor could be just like, hey, what is the church supposed to do? And statement making is not really the most critical task of the church. You know, that's not what we're called to do. We're not even anointed for that. And the church, when I mean church, I don't mean me and I don't mean established church. I mean church people. If we are supposed to be, we are supposed to comfort the oppressed, regardless who they are. You know, I think when...
Hey, but before you move on, I really like what you said as far as statement making isn't even what we're, I think you said, anointed for. Go into that a little bit more.
Well, I mean, when Jesus said, I'll build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And what he's saying is the church is called to do one thing, and that is rescue people, to go and go through hell to rescue and people to get them out. Like, in a sense, not to stay away from that, to move towards pain, suffering, and to rescue and all that. And we're supposed to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And the opposition is already taken care of. Jesus is saying, hey, the end result of all of this is already set. Love will prevail. Right now, your job is taking care of your neighbor. That's powerful, man.
Yeah. And I think a couple of thoughts. One is like this idea of anger. So 9/11 happened. 9/11 happened. And, you know, Greg, you know, you were with us and you walked with us through that. And I remember calling you up and going, what do I do? And I think you were out of town.
I was in Chicago. Yeah.
And I started apologizing. Like, I don't know what I should do. And I remember we had like a service the next day and I got up from the church and I apologized. And I just knew I need to step into that moment. And, you know, I had people going, why are you apologizing for? And I'm like, I represent someone. So a people group who have, like, mm-hmm. I look like, I represent someone or people that have caused pain in other people. So I'm just stepping in. I'm just trying to do the right thing here. And the backlash of that was also, you know, me doing that and walking with the church community, but then also walking the streets of Charleston, being called, you know, Osama bin Laden, you know, and knowing that forever I would, now, because of the way I look, it's going to be a conversation. It's going to be a thing. So what I realized is that problem is that if people don't process their anger, they're going to act in ways that honestly, they don't even want to do that. Like, I mean, so I feel like even nations do that. What they do is they don't process pain really well. And I mean, pain is a reaction, maybe even a distraction from what's really going on inside. Like, why are you mad? It's talking to a child or talking to a person or talking to a patient saying, okay, why are you having these feelings? Well, I'm angry because I feel powerless. I'm angry because I feel sad. I'm angry because they shamed me. And I just feel like what's happening in 9/11, but what also happened, honestly, I mean, if I don't want to rock the boat here, but what even happened with dropping a nuclear bomb, you know, there was a response of like, you will not do this. The response came harsh. And we've seen this with 9/11. It came harsh. I mean, I remember my mom being escorted out as a 6-year-old woman, deported and then banned from the country for 3 years. And then, you know, I think, Greg, you were there for that, too.
I was there. Yeah.
So You know, we've heard the idea like hurting people hurt people. Hurting nations hurt nations. Like, they do that. And if this pain, which is deep, which has a lot of history and it's complicated, if they don't process this, they're just going to continue to pass it down through generations. And that's what they're doing. That's why, going back to your question, Joey, is, you know, when I asked the teacher, why do we hate the Jews? She had no idea. Like, we don't know. Why? Because it's just pain that hasn't been processed. It's like, we haven't figured this out.
Yeah. With the unprocessed pain. So are you saying that's what's leading to the violence, like almost humanizing the aggressors?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at the history of it, and it's complicated, and I'm not a historian. I have researched and read, and what the history books tell us is that that region right there was called Syria-Palestine. And there was a history of Jewish people living there. And I'm broad stroking this thing, okay? But you had Jewish people living there. You had Roman empires, killing off millions of Jews. The Jews have been the center of like all kinds of violence throughout history.
Wait, have Christians have killed people back in the day too? Christians have killed?
Christians have killed some people. Yes, for sure. Honestly, all religious people have done this in the name of their God, which is the problem, you know, one of the problems. But yeah, so they took it was their land. And then you had all these empires come in. You had the Ottoman Empire, the Byzantine, you had the Persians come in, you had all those, and which led to having to leave that region, and then for them to call it something else. I mean, they called it, I think, Syria-Palestine. It wasn't called the Gaza Strip or West Bank. And then you had all these Jewish people dispersed all over the world. And then I believe it was really the strong anti-Semitism that took place in Europe, especially in World War II, where now these Jewish people were being persecuted everywhere. I mean, with Hitler and all that as well. And Jewish people came back to this region as refugees, history tells us. But problem was, is that by that time, you had the caliphates establish some things. You had some Christians establish their churches there. You had Arabs in there as well. So you had this one place that at one point was the temple, the Jewish temple, that got destroyed. Then you had, I believe it was like a temple to like an idol, Jupiter, was built there. Then Christians came over and got rid of that. Then the Muslims came in and built a mosque there. So you got all this one space that has like all kinds of history thrown in. People are like, we were here, you were here, you left, you came here. Like, so it's like, what's going on? So you've got all that history to kind of go, okay, what's happening? You know, so when Jewish people go, well, you don't know what's happening to us. And I'm like, well, I don't know. You know, the Holocaust was, oh my gosh. But then you talk to Palestinians, they think of 1948, and I believe it's called the Nakba, which is their Holocaust, you know?
Which was at the hands of who or what country?
I believe it was Western. Yeah, it was the... In 1948, I think, I'm not quite sure if my facts are right, because you had the white papers, you had a couple of, again, I'm not the guy to quote on this, but it wasn't a Jewish or Arab thing. At that time, and before then, the British Empire was like really in charge of setting the tone for what was happening. I mean, I think they actually presented a two-state government and things like that. And, you know, both of them rejected, then one of them rejected. I mean, it's always been that kind of issue. And I think that's why people will hear online people of, you know, it's the British people who are at fault. I mean, like, you can blame any empire and all that. The problem is the mess we're in right here. you know.
I'm curious as to you and Pastor Greg, but Pastor Greg, would you think that maybe it's safe to say that, because as Naeem's talking, I do believe that we're called to try and love the most unlovable and even humanize the most unlovable. I wonder if now is not the time to publicly humanize when there's people who are being slaughtered, tortured the most horrific way, but maybe in our hearts praying, Lord, please give me love. I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, it's complicated. Naeem said it's complicated. Part of it's complicated, part of it's simple in my mind. The complicated part is the history part. You know, where do we start history? Do we start it at 1947? Do we start it at 1948? Do we start it 150 years before that? Do we start at 2,000 years ago? Do we start at 6,000 years ago?
Or Isaac and Ishmael.
Yeah, where do you start it? So you've got a complicated history that has a complicated political process that is, like, I don't have three steps for that. I just don't. That's very complicated. The simple part is you've got good versus evil here. You know, good people don't go and do some of the things that Hamas militants did, you know, on that day just a month ago. And what's sad to me is that, and I guess it's the way that war is awful. You know, I mean, anybody that flippantly in our country says we ought to have a civil war or we need to go to war with, you know, whoever, you need to step back and go, war is awful. It's just awful. Mm-hmm. There are times for wars. There are seasons when, you know, people have to ward off evil. And I think that's what's going on right now in Israel. I'm not one that feels like I need to give the Israeli government a pass for everything that they do because they're Jewish. You know, I just don't. But I do believe that you've got a good versus evil thing going on here. And what's sad is that with propaganda, fake news, whatever you want to call it these days, you know, it's hard to know what to believe as far as numbers and this, that, and the other that are coming out. And the Israeli government is being forced to make pictures that are horrific available. They just did that to their whole, whatever they call their Congress recently, because people forget what happened here. This was an evil, evil thing that is supported by, I think, as Naeem talked about a minute ago, a very small minority of the Palestinian people, Muslim, and Palestinian people include Muslims, Christians. So it's a very, very small minority of people who have held them hostage, you know, allegedly has taken aid money, has built, you know, weapons of war around hospitals and schools and all this kind of thing. So you've got evil there that somehow must be uprooted. That's above my pay grade. I don't know how you do that. You've got political solutions for all of the complicated history that we've got. Again, that's above my pay grade. What is in my pay grade is just to have compassion for those that are hurting, those that are innocent, you know, those that have been disrupted by all of this. When I look at the reports on TV, I have to have compassion and I have to say, what can we do to help, regardless of what the nationality is?
Right. Yeah.
So I don't know if that answers questions, but that's kind of where I am.
Yeah.
That was not simple. You said it's simple in a sense. But
well, there's a piece of it. Good versus evil, I think, is the only simple part.
Yeah. But then you go, okay, so if we don't war against flesh and blood, but against principalities, what does that mean? Is that just a cool scripture, or is that really, how does that translate to really, like, you got to actually govern people correctly? You know, how do you do that? Mm-hmm. And I think one person said, like, you know, you can't work for peace and reconciliation and give unconditional support to anyone. And I thought, huh, that's interesting. Yeah, that would be hard to do. How do you do that? But how do you figure out, like, okay, who is the real enemy? Like, I think for me, my danger was like, hey, let's not demonize Arabs and Muslims. Like, let's not do that, because that's going to translate over to other parts of the world. You know, that's what the 9/11 connection is for me, is because, I mean, dude, I mean, just crazy, crazy. The Sikhs are Indians. They're Sikhs. Their religion calls them to not, the guys don't cut their hair. So they have turbans. I mean, the amount of Sikhs after 9/11 in New York and other parts that were like brutally terrorized, it was ridiculous. And they're just idiots doing this because they thought they were Muslims. They're like, we're not even Muslims, man.
Now, there's a difference to me in 9/11 and what has happened here. There's several differences. One is, this is multiple times bigger than 9/11. Okay. When you look at the number of people in the country and the number of people that are in, that were murdered by the Hamas militants. So you've got that. At 9/11, we had a group of Islamic militants who came and did what they did and believed that Israel doesn't have a right to exist and that America is the great Satan and needs to be taken down and destroyed. Okay. Similar. The difference is they were over there. Okay. And we're here. So we went and we did a war over there. And you can talk about that or not talk about it. I think there has to be consequences for evil, whether we recognize that we are not battling against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. But when principalities and powers use flesh and blood, there are consequences for the action that they take. So that can be complicated too, but there are consequences. In Israel, you've got the same attitude from the, what is it, from the rivers to the ocean, or rivers to the sea, you know, this will be Palestine again, which basically says Israel doesn't have a right to exist. When that attitude is at home or surrounding you, not every Muslim, by any means, and a radical group that has taken political power, then that is that's how do we deal with that? You know, and for me to sit in America and say, well, you don't have a right to do this, that, or the other, you know, again, I think that's hard.
Right.
What I can do is I can say, I am for oppressed people everywhere, and regardless of who they are, what they are, I am not sympathetic whatsoever to the radical philosophy that is at the root of all of this. You know, I mean, there are innocents all over the place in this thing.
I agree. Yeah, it's tough because certain kind of wars are justified. A just war is to bring justice, but so on. You know, humanity sometimes will go into this war of revenge or extermination. Mm-hmm. And that's that spirit that I pray that would not go in any camp, you know, like, hey, wipe them all out. I mean, either start a genocide and find all these people anywhere in the world and get rid of them, or ethnic cleansing to just like everyone who looks like this or believes this or is a Muslim or whatever, kill them, you know, and nations have done that. And it's hard for me, like you were saying, it's hard for me to go, well, that nation's right and that nation is wrong. I'm like, no, there's good and evil. And if good people, even if the oppressed begin to do evil things, you have to call out evil for what it is. Like, it's evil. You know, it's not justified, because once you start justifying evil, you can justify, obviously, justice, going after justice. But once you start justifying evil, it's just a slippery slope, you know, because then you dehumanize people and you go, well, they versus us, and we can treat them like that because of that.
Yeah, I even tried to, and this isn't, you guys aren't saying anything that I disagree with, so this isn't a contrary statement, but I try to imagine, and this will sound kind of silly, but imagine Osama bin Laden as a newborn baby, and I don't know, Martin Luther King as a newborn baby. You take both of those babies, there's no difference. They're newborn babies. They're completely 100% not conscious of complex thinking. They haven't learned really anything philosophical, religious. What happened from that time to the time they're adults? And you really do have to take in consideration that some of these people have been raised and brainwashed to think and act and believe the way that they do. And I only say that for me personally, because I don't know how else to love my enemies when it comes to this. My neighbor, it's an Israeli family. They're here for about 7 years for a work assignment, and they were actually in Israel for about a month voluntarily. And I just saw him the other day, and he actually, you know, was trying not to break down, but I was just asking him some questions, and he said, whatever you could imagine the horrific nature of what's going on, multiply it by about 10. The sorts of things that are happening, he says, I won't even speak them. And he did talk about rape, burning people, torturing people. And then he said, and there's some things I can't even speak. I'm like, what's worse than that? Gosh, it's really a tough one. And I think this is where we really have to dig in deep and find love. But I don't know what that looks like.
I think we have to be careful, too, with a moral equivalency, which said these people did this, Israel is doing that. So it's, basically the same. And I don't think so. Now, if Israel is torturing and raping and burning and all of that, that's evil everywhere. We don't do that. You know, and again, that's a complicated concept, but that is a concept that you hear a lot, you know, just out there today. Well, they did this, and so they're doing the same thing. Well, they're not doing the same thing. We have to be careful that we don't go buy into what Naeem was just saying. And that I said that even people I know that, well, let's just wipe out all the Arabs or what, not Arabs, it's Muslims which most Arabs probably are. And that's a simplified solution to yeah. a difficult thing. And we as believers are called to love. Now, again, there's consequences for yeah. people doing what they do.
Yeah. As I was just thoughts here, you know, the whole idea of like Jesus' teachings on turning the cheek. You know, turn the other cheek. If someone slaps you on the other side, on one side, give them the other cheek. I think there's this idea of like, okay, first, either you just forgive them or you let people run all over you. That's one idea. Or some people will just go, you know what? I don't even believe in that. That's too much of Jesus' teaching. I'm not going to apply that to my business. I'm not going to apply that to how I deal with humanity. But you know what's interesting about that idea of turning the cheek is that in the Arab world, the Muslim world, the Jewish world, all this Arabian world or whatever, this idea of slapping someone in the face is very much super dishonorable. Like it's just like, that's a big, big deal. I know that in the U.S. you have like slap wars and things like that. They made it a competition here, but back there it's pretty a big deal. And when Jesus says, you know, if someone slaps you, turn the other cheek, what he's really saying is call out the injustice, because the only way to slap my other side is to backhand me. And backhanding someone in that culture is a very cowardice thing to do. So he was like, point out the injustice. Like it's really a powerful teaching of like, remind that person that the one you're slapping is human and you're doing this. Like, so when you slap me on one side and I turn, you can't switch hands. You're going to do this. And so I think at least my interpretation of what Jesus was saying is when it was call that out. So when he said, you know, when the Romans tell you to walk a mile, walk two, remind them that when you are a free person and you're going to choose to walk another mile because you are still in control. I think like Jesus' teachings on justice needs to remind the church even like always make this a human conversation, never a conversation of land. And I mean, land's going to go away. All these kingdoms are going to go away, all this. But man, make this a human thing. I think like the church needs to make sure this is a very human thing.
Yeah, I've got a theory and I'm curious what y'all think. I think there's a possibility with what we know about God's kingdom and that being the eternal kingdom, what Jesus represented. I think maybe there's a chance that ultimately we are called to universal nonviolence, but I think when we stand before the throne, Jesus is going to be like, but I totally, totally understand how that seemed almost absolutely impossible, because I don't adopt a complete non-violent approach to life at all. And I think maybe we're called to, but there are certain situations where I would just say, God, I understand that may be what your kingdom is about. I'm too weak. I have to do something. What do y'all think? Do y'all think there's a chance that we go to heaven? And it's like, nah, you're supposed to be completely nonviolent in any and every situation. Cause that's, I don't think I'll ever be able to live that way. And that sounds like a cop out.
I don't know. If you are tasked with keeping the peace, you are a, you know, even as the Romans in the book of Romans would, I think it's Romans that says that, you know, we need to obey those in authority and that they are there. And part of the government's responsibility is to keep people safe. Okay. That's the government responsibility. If I am a soldier and I am employed by working for the government, and part of my task as an employee of the government is to keep the people safe, and part of that is to do violence to the enemy, I don't believe I'm violating God's word in that. And there would be believers that would disagree with that. Okay. There are those that would say you should never be a part of the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, whatever it happens to be, because you should be nonviolent all of the time. And I think they have a valid point. That may be where you're coming from. I just don't agree, which doesn't make me right. Now, how I do what I'm tasked to do, if my evilness or evilness inside of me takes it in a direction that is evil, then that's not right. That's wrong. But I don't know that I would agree with a stand that says there is never a time for violence. You know, if somebody breaks into my home and threatens my wife, if I can do anything to defend her, which is a part of what my responsibility is, or defend my family, I am not going to feel guilty, nor am I going to feel like I have violated God's ultimate will for my life.
Yeah. And I agree. That's the position that I take, but I still wonder,
yeah,
we live forever in God's kingdom. And so I wonder if it's just like, yeah, if your wife is killed, then she lives forever in God's kingdom. Same thing for the rest of your family. But I'm with you, Pastor Greg. I mean, there's no way I could adhere to that. And I do think that there's somewhat of a difference in how I see governments function, because I completely agree that a government's responsibility is to keep people safe. And sometimes that's going to require conflict. But I think, you know, in my personal life is where I really evaluate the whole nonviolence thing. But Naeem, I'm curious, because obviously we both look up to Pastor Greg, more of a fatherly figure, mentor, that sort of thing. When you hear, and I want, for our listener's sake, when Pastor Greg is saying good versus evil, he is talking specifically about what is going on in Israel, not a broad stroke of like Muslims and Christians or anything like that. But Naeem, do you have any reservations with Pastor Greg saying this is good versus evil when it comes to what's going on in Israel right now? Because it kind of seems like that's a little bit of an uneasy territory for you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a, so yes, there's always a conflict between darkness and light and good and evil, right? There's always a difference. That's going to be the fight. I mean, Jesus prayed against it. We're called to come against it, all that. So there's always that kind of idea. It's sometimes hard to figure out who's doing what. So like, for example, this idea of violence, right? So I don't have any problem with violence. You know, even if you look at the creation story of Adam and Eve, God did a violent act to sacrifice his creation to cover the nakedness of the man and the woman. You know, I mean, it was not fig leaves, it was fur. So that was a violent act. And so when violence takes place, when we do violent things to kill for food, to provide, when we kill for protection, we do violent things. I don't think I have an issue with violence. I think that's part of life and part of this fallen world. I mean, that's part of the deal. But violence is a part of life. There's a difference between violence and terrorism. If you begin to terrorize people in your life, regardless how you do it, you are acting like a terrorist. So if there's a difference between violence and taking a gun to protect, now I'm terrorizing and I'm making my whole community feel uncomfortable. The domestic terrorism exists because that term came to be when it wasn't foreign terrorism, it was local. Why? Because there are people who make people, who create terror in people's lives and hearts. So I think that's the big difference. If you can create terror by violence or by other ways as well. So that's why it's so complicated because I have friends who, Shadia is one of my friends who has family there right now. And she's terrorized by the idea of these bombings, the Israeli bombings. She's terrorized because she's like, I'm going to lose my cousins. So in her mind, unfortunately, this is a regime that's terrorizing her. Does that make sense? Which is not her fault, but it's not good versus evil. It's just understanding the responsibility, like Greg was saying, that you can move from violence to terrorism really quickly. And you just gotta remember, I like guns because I like shooting. Oh, I just like shooting everybody. Well, hold on. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. I have no problem taking a life.
That's a good analogy. I like that.
So,
very good analogy.
Yeah, and that's great context for what Pastor Greg is saying as far as there is a difference.
There is.
And I don't know the details of what has actually happened in history, but I don't think Israel has ever terrorized other countries. What's going on right now?
But I mean, that's what's hard though, because if you talk to the Arab, Arab churches, I mean, their response, local to response, living there is like, hey, this is terrorizing us. I'm not saying they're terrorists. Israelis are terrorists. I'm just saying, dude, when I was in a war and bombings were happening, oh my gosh. I mean, we were terrorized by this regime. I mean, they'd walk into our houses and do whatever they wanted to do, terrorized by the idea of it. You know what I'm saying? Maybe I call them terrorists. I'm just saying it's what we felt. It's what we lived. I believe that Hamas needs to be eradicated. I think extremists in any shape need to be eradicated, because the only way you can be the extreme is to dehumanize another group and then justify not just prejudice and distrust, but also violence against them and terror against them to make them feel a certain way. How do you kill that? That's how do you kill evil? You know what I'm saying? That's the problem. How do you kill it?
Wow, that's a good question, man.
Either you hunt it down or you just start being the, I hate saying it, like loving people out of it. But I think the church has a greater responsibility, the American church, to kind of really think through like, hey, we want to be, like Greg said, on the side of the, and to comfort the oppressed, That's what we really need to be.
Yeah, and we can wrap this thing up here soon. But what Christians tend to do, it's like they take the events that's going on right now, and I'm going to make up a word, but they biblicalize everything. So they you like that? and they get obsessed with what this means in times and all of that. And I'm curious what you think about that, because sometimes, and I'm not even saying that they're off in what they're saying. It's not a matter of right or wrong. But I sometimes wonder, when we're so obsessed with that, are we also thinking about the oppressed and the horrible things that are happening to people, because we're so obsessed with what does this mean for us? And I will say that it is a little disheartening, and I've lived a lot of my life the same way, and I think it's part of being human. But we Christians, we see persecution as something, Lord, please rapture us up so we don't have to be persecuted, and the church flourishes in persecution. Like, why would we not dig deeper into the Spirit and say, Lord, use me during this time of great persecution. But how do you feel about the infatuation with Israel, Naeem?
So glad you asked that. You know, so coming into Christianity from a Muslim background, I've just been able to I realize, okay, I grew up hating the Jews, and now I'm like, now I'm giving my whole life to a Jewish rabbi, you know, I flipped over. And so I got the perks of, you know, being Middle Eastern, and people go, okay, you look like Jesus. And, so you must be right. And I got the privilege of people going, assuming that I was an expert in all these things. But what I did realize is that there is an infatuation, and I'll use that word not out of disrespect, but there's an interest, you know, of like people, Christians, I would say Western Christians, maybe American Christians, with Israel. My concern is that if you take those biblical prophecy literally, and you hear Jesus talking about rumors of wars and this has happened, that's going to happen, then you go, okay, this is it. This is happening. And what really needs to happen is that we're going to be raptured. And the last 50 years, you know, I think it seems like Americans, I mean, when I came into the Christianity, I was like, it was all about the rapture. We're going to be taken up. This is going to happen. Jesus is going to come back to come against the Antichrist. And so if you have this theology, good or bad, right or wrong, about this end times, you know, left behind kind of a deal, which, you know, and you're more focused on getting out of this world in versus God's kingdom here on earth. And the whole goal is get saved and get ready to go, because I've got a mansion in heaven waiting for me and streets of gold, which we can go into all kinds of things and why that's so, you know, toxic sometimes. But if you believe that, I would say that the fascination seems to be is because we need Jesus. We need Jewish people to summon Jesus back. Like we need Jewish people to come back in power, to rebuild the temple. Do we need Jesus to come down, you know, come against the Antichrist? We need to do that. Why? Because if that happens, boom, rapture, all that, and we're out of this world. So the problem with that, though, sometimes is like, I've worried like, hey, do we love Jewish people, or we just have a transactional relationship with Jewish people? Like, why do we really love Jewish people? Do we love them because they're God's people, or God used them to show the world who he was? Or do we just love Jewish people because they're human and they're made in the image of God? Like, why do we love them? And I think they go, well, they're God's chosen people. Well, hold up. I thought, aren't we all? Like, no, they're really, really chosen. Well, then it goes like, what do you mean they're really, really chosen? Well, you know, Jesus is going to come back, and that's all these, the veil's got to be torn. All these things have got to happen. The temple's got to be rebuilt. And I just feel like if I was a Jewish person, I'd be like, so you're just using me to summon Jesus? And then when we do go up in heaven, where am I going? Because I don't believe in Jesus. Oh, well, you're going to the lake of fire. Oh, what? So does that make sense to a Jewish mind? Because I have Israeli friends, and they go, you guys, the American church is just using us. They're just using us. I never heard this. I'm like, oh, wow. I'm sorry. I didn't even know. Right.
So the interesting point of view. Very, very interesting. I had not thought of it that way. So I've always been pretty shallow on this. And recently I have embraced my shallowness as I'm happy for it. But, you know, we all know folks that are really, you know, somewhat obsessed with end time stuff. And I have friends, I love them. And what I've come to realize is that everybody's different. Everybody's not like me. I'm not the calibrator of what is right in the world. We see things from different points of view. I have never been interested in that stuff, ever. I have a theology that, you know, I believe that Jesus is coming. I believe that there will be a rapture. When that will happen, will it be before this, after this, whatever, I'm not really too focused in on all of that. And that the heaven that we go to when we die is not the ultimate, you know, place that we're going to be forever. I believe that the world will be restored and renewed. I also believe that it's going to be a better place than it was when I got it. That's part of my responsibility. I don't think things are going to hell in a handbasket. I think they're getting better. And I can make a case for that, that the more that the light spreads, the better it gets. Here's the deal. Here's the deal. So people would ask me, so when do you think the rapture is going to be? When do you think the end is going to come? All the stuff that we see around us, how does it play into historic prophecy? And my answer has always been, I don't know. I'm not on the date and time committee. I'm on the Occupy Until He Returns committee. And that's always been kind of a shallow response, but it's what I believe. I can't get, you know, I think Mark Turnage told us when he was on a few weeks ago that prophecy is best seen in the rearview mirror. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it really is. You go, oh, okay, that's what that was.
Yeah.
My job is to occupy. My job is to rule. I would call that in my kind of a philosophy of identity, purpose, and assignment, the three words that I talk about a lot, that my job, my purpose is to rule, is to bring the kingdom rule of God into every situation, which is not political, nor is it physical. It is a spiritual, it is the love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, mm-hmm. goodness, long-suffering. It's spreading the kingdom to everybody I encounter and I touch. And so as I look at what's going on in the world today, do I know where it fits in prophecy? Absolutely not. I don't. You say that you do. We're all guessing. Okay, that's right. But what I can control, what I can control is that I bring the kingdom rule of God, that I'm becoming a better representation of who God is every day. I bring that into all of my relationships, and I love those that God brings into my arena to love. So that's my end times philosophy. It's pretty shallow, but I'm real, real comfortable with it.
Yeah, I couldn't really keep up because you didn't have one of those big maps behind you pointing stuff out. So I wasn't following. Yeah.
Well, there are people that, and there's some interesting stuff.
Oh, yeah.
There really is.
Yeah. But Naeem, I remember when bombs were flying at Desert Storm, I was petrified I was sure the rapture was going to happen that night. I remember watching the TV, going to bed, thinking it's going to happen while I'm asleep. I hope I'm okay. And
yeah,
Pastor Greg, let me ask you a real touchy feely question. Are you proud of Naeem? Because you had him here at Seacoast for a long time.
Very, very proud of Naeem. Very proud of him. I couldn't be more proud.
Do you have any funny Naeem stories to wrap it up?
Oh, God, no.
Nope.
There's so many. Oh, most of them are inappropriate.
Yeah, they are. No, I love Naeem and Ashley. I am so proud of them, proud of who they are, who their family is, how they love people, their church. I couldn't be more proud. And in this conversation, we don't have to agree on everything to have unity. And I think you hear that just a little bit. We all have our own background. We all have our ways of looking at life. But you know what? We love each other.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to point that there was major differences. I don't know that there were. But as you listen, you get nuances of this, that, or the other. People can go, well, you don't agree with Naeem or you don't agree with Joey on that. Well, you know, I might or I might not, but I agree on this. We are loved by God, that we serve, the same Savior.
Right.
And we agree on most things. And if you agree on everything, then one of you is not necessary. that's where I'm at.
No, yeah. I mean, yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to have this conversation partly because I feel like I'm getting messages from people like, hey, you should talk about this, or you should not talk about this, or you should do. I'm like, I don't even want to talk about, you know. And then I've got some pastor friends who are like asking me, you know, how about this solution? How about that solution? I'm like, really? You're going to figure this out like for the rest of the world? Like, really? And you want my help?
It's been a while them trying to figure it out.
Right. It's people, and people are complicated, messy, inconsistent. And that's why you need a God who can love them unconditionally. And that's it.
Thanks for listening. There's a link in the show notes to our podcast Facebook page where we talk about these episodes and share some behind-the-scenes information, including guests we're booking. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.